When we gave our kids a phone, we told them, like, this is not your phone. This is my phone. I'm letting you use this phone.
Oh, wow.
And I don't do that because I'm being draconian or I'm being mean, because I afforded them their privacy. But what they needed to know was, objective right or wrong can't be objective right or wrong because dad says so or because mom says so. It has to be right or wrong because it is. Which means that at some point, your kids are going to reach a certain level of cognition and comprehension to where they're going to find you doing the thing that you told them was wrong. She goes, Daddy, I don't think you handled that very well. And she's about like 13, 14 years old. I could remember for a split second that kind of pride welling up in me, like, oh, you don't think I handled something very well. Well, pray tell. Here's a cheat code for dads.
Nick Freitas, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you got these cups, but like, what's the story behind the cups?
So one day, I was making some sort of smart aleck observation about something that was going on in the news. And I just took a sip of my coffee at the end of it because I was standing out on my front porch. And people apparently thought it was funny because every other reel I did after that, people would ask, where's your coffee mug? It doesn't hit the same without the coffee mug. And before I knew it, people were sending me coffee mugs. And so, yeah, that's become a thing now at the end of our reels and our YouTube shorts, is I usually have some sort of witty statement on a coffee mug or something like that I'll finish off the reel with.
Well, it's funny. I've been very entertained.
Good.
I wanted to do this podcast and kind of focus it on kids, because I've seen like a lot of your content on Instagram is how to raise children properly. And I haven't done a podcast on that before. And I'm ridiculously pregnant right now. So it's kind of in line with what I'm thinking about. But I thought we could cover a bunch of kid questions. But before that, just a brief background about who you are, because I read that you've got... Well, I'm going to just butcher my description, so you should go. But you're a Green Beret. I don't even know what that means. So we could start there.
Sure. So, my wife and I met in high school. We got married, less than a year out of high school. I was 19. She was 20. She doesn't like when I remind people that, you know, she's 9 months older than me. But got married out of high school. I was in the 82nd Airborne Division in the United States Army at that point. When 9/11 kicked off, I volunteered for Army Special Forces, better known as Green Berets. And kind of what makes Green Berets unique within the military is we focus a lot on unconventional warfare, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, but we work by, through, and with the local population. So we operate in small 12-man teams. And we usually, like, for instance, when I was in, I did my tours in Iraq, I worked with Iraqi military, Iraqi militia, Iraqi police. When I wasn't in Iraq, we'd be in a different foreign country training everyone from Korean Special Missions Group to Bangladeshi border guards. So that was really our role as Green Berets, is we went all over the world working with America's allies, providing host nation capacity and working by, through, and with the local population when it came to conducting combat operations. But I did that for a while, got out in 2009, shortly after my second tour in Iraq. My wife and I have three kids. All of them were born when I was in the military. My oldest daughter now is 21 and about to get married herself. My son just turned 18, and my youngest daughter is about to turn 16. And when I got out of the military, I still did some work kind of within the defense area. We've also homeschooled for quite a while, which I have to give my wife the vast majority of the credit for that. And I also, although I don't like to admit it in public, I'm also an elected official. So I serve in the Virginia House of Delegates as a state legislator. And I always joke that... I once was a soldier, which I considered an honorable profession, and then I became a filthy politician.
Hey, guess who's not pregnant? This girl. That's right. I'll update you guys about the baby soon in a Q&A. He is so cute. I can't stand it. And I'm so tired. I have enough energy for ads, and that's it. That's why this episode was delayed a week. So, check out After Party. Buy it for Christmas and the holidays and New Year's, and you will thank me. Buy it for people you like and not for people you want to have alcohol-induced brain damage. I'm joking. It's hard to believe something actually works for hangovers, but this works, and it helps save your brain from any alcohol consumption, which is not good for you, even small amounts, but it's fun, sometimes anyway. fullerhealth.com, code XMAS20 for 20% off. I also haven't mentioned this, but it can be taken before you drink to reduce the amount you drink. At least that's what it does if you give it to rats. So if you're trying to drink less, take it before you drink and after and in the morning. And if you don't want to reduce how much you drink, take it as directed. Linked in the comments, fullerhealth.com. There's a money-back guarantee, so you can give them a shot with no worries on refunds. Have a very Merry Christmas. My parents are here. I have a new baby. My hormones are more normal. I like my husband again after a few months of pregnancy hormones. Life is good. Talk to you guys soon. So I was talking, we were watching this show the other day, my husband and I, and it's called The Patriot. And how did you and your wife negotiate you going into the Army? Like, I don't think I could imagine myself marrying someone and then they decide to go, I mean, serve their country.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could handle that. So was that something that you discussed with her beforehand, or had you had that plan for a long time? Because you said you volunteered after 9/11. Well, so was that a
I had actually joined thing? Before. I had actually joined before. So okay. my wife and I were high school sweethearts. We started dating our senior year of high school, and she knew I wanted to go into the military. And so 2 weeks after high school graduation, I was on my way to Fort Benning, Georgia to go through infantry basic training and airborne school. And we got married. I left in June of 98 to go into the military. And then we got married in May of 99. And wow. So when she came out, I was a private in the military. She came out to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, was looking for work. We were like totally dirt poor. It was good times. But she knew I wanted to be in the military, but it was a peacetime army at that point, and we thought we were actually going to get out. And then we reenlisted one more time because when you reenlisted the first time, you can kind of pick your duty station. And so we decided to get stationed in Hawaii. And, shortly after getting to Hawaii, 9/11 took place. And I remember looking at Tina then going, well, I want to volunteer to go Army Special Forces, because, you know, my attitude was if there's going to be a war, I'm going to be in it. And that was obviously tough for her, but by the same token, I don't think she didn't have any expectations that I was going to do anything different once that took place. And I have to say, after the first 10 years of our marriage, if you add up all the time away on training, on combat tours, on everything else, I probably spent half of it away from home. And so there were times where, you know, we had, for my first deployment, we had two kids. For my third or my second deployment, we had three kids. She had to go through a lot. And I always tell people the reason why I believe I have such a good relationship with all my children is in large part to the work that she did on the home front when I was overseas and when I was gone for training, because it would have been really easy for her to get upset or bitter or angry or feel kind of left. And she didn't. She always looked at it as we're both serving. We're just serving in different ways. And when I would go off to Iraq, she would make little shirts for the kids with, you know, my face on them. And she would send videos of them, you know, telling them how much they love their daddy. And I would try to send videos back. But she always reinforced to the kids that, look, daddy's got to be away, not because he doesn't love you, but because he has an important job to do. And our job is to support him. And so when I came home, I didn't receive any bitterness or sense of abandonment from my children. They were just happy to see me. And had Tina not put in the work that she did, I don't think that would have happened.
Wow. Well, good for you guys. That's really incredible to be able to navigate that in a relationship. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I was watching a show the other day and I was like, I don't know. I feel like I would get resentful. Like, I know my personality. Like, I don't know if I could handle that as a woman. I don't know if I could handle it. So that's really impressive. And that kind of segues into some of the questions I wanted to ask you, because I talk to my followers on Instagram, because I usually ask if they have questions just to see what's poking around in people's unconscious. And there were a lot of women who asked questions about raising strong men.
Yeah.
If the dad was either away or not involved. I was actually surprised at the number of women who didn't seem to have a man in their life that were saying, hey, I realize that this isn't an ideal situation. How do I make sure I don't raise, you know, How do I make sure I raise a strong man? So if you were away for part of the, you know, periods of childhood, that means Tina, your wife, I guess, would have handled discipline in those instances, maybe when they were younger. How do you think you guys managed it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. We get asked this so much on Instagram that we finally did a video on it where we just said what they don't tell moms about raising young men. And both Tina and I grew up in homes where our parents were divorced. And my father was still very influential in my life, but I got to see my dad during the summers primarily. And then he would come up for various events or holidays or things like that. But I would go down to Southern California and spend the time with my dad. And so I didn't get to see my dad as much as I would have liked. He didn't get to see me as much as he would have liked, but he was still involved. And so that put some additional stress on my mom. One of the things that was very beneficial for that is I had great grandfathers. My grandfathers were outstanding, and so were my grandmothers as well. But when it came to being able to provide a positive male role model and influence in my life, both of my grandfathers were critical to that purpose. And I think that's one of the things that I would tell women that are growing up or that are trying to raise young men in a less than ideal situation, because that's the other thing I don't want to sugarcoat here. Anybody that tells you that, oh, it's fine, you can do it, you just got to be strong. No, it's not ideal. It wasn't meant to be this way. You weren't supposed to have to raise your son without a father in the household to both assist you and help you and help your son become a man, and also help your daughters understand what it is, what a positive relationship with a man looks like. So it is difficult for moms to try to find those positive male role models. Sometimes it's in the form of a pastor. Sometimes it's in the form of a coach. Sometimes it's in a form of a family member, like an uncle or a grandfather. Sometimes it's in the form of your son's friend who has a great dad in his life that is willing to help kind of play that role and help provide some of that guidance. The one thing that I will tell single moms, and I don't say this to scare them, I say it just because it's a fact, it's a reality, is that there are other men that will see that as a vulnerable situation and attempt to take advantage of it. And so the mother does have to play a role where she is protective of her son's innocence, especially when he's in those vulnerable formative years, and it isn't able to discern what a threat looks like in the form of another man. So I would just tell single moms, it is possible. My mom did an excellent job of it. I have a wonderful relationship with my mother. I'm eternally grateful for her. That's one of the things I talked about in that video about women raising young men, was how grateful I was for some of the things that my mom did. So try to find those positive male role models. They're necessary. You know, a father cannot be completely replaced by a mother any more than a mother can be replaced by a father. The other thing I will say is that one of the things that happens, I think, between, and I say this obviously not based off of my own experience from a mother's perspective, but talking to my own mother, talking to my wife. My wife was nervous about having a little boy. She was nervous about it. We had our oldest daughter first, and so she wasn't sure. And the moment he was born, oh my gosh, that little boy stole her heart like you would not believe. That was her little man. And there's this thing when a little boy is small, his mother is Wonder Woman, right? She's the most, you know, beautiful, wonderful, incredible, human being on the planet. And he's who she goes to make the world better, right? When it doesn't make sense to him, when he gets hurt, whatever it is, right? You know, mommy can pick you up, snuggle you, give you a kiss on the boo-boo, and all of a sudden it's healed, right? She's just, it really is somewhat like magical. When your little boy starts to get older, though, a lot of the things that made your little boy feel loved or supported or safe or secure when they were little starts to make them feel weak or vulnerable as they get older. And this varies based off of the boy and the situation that they're growing up in. But I would say for most of them, it's probably around junior high, maybe a little bit earlier for some, maybe a little bit older for others. A lot of it depends on the environment they're in when they're, you know, going to school, they're educated, what they're exposed to and at what age. If you can protect your son's innocence for as long as you can, and by protecting the innocence, I don't mean not exposing them to things that are age appropriate or difficulties or challenges. That needs to happen. It's part of their development. But about things that are not age appropriate, But at some point, they're going to get their butt kicked at school, or something's going to happen, or they're getting in a fight. And the instinct that mom has is, I'm going to step in and I'm going to protect them. And look, if there's something dangerous going on, you need to do that. I'm not suggesting otherwise. However, your little boy doesn't want the bully to be afraid of mom. He doesn't want the bully to be afraid of the principal. He wants the bully to be afraid of him. He wants to feel strong and capable. And so there's things that a mom can do that can kind of call out that protector and that provider, that are components of being a good man. I don't care what the new gender norms say about what we're supposed to do. I could care less about the studies coming out of the sociology department at Cal Berkeley. A good man can protect and a good man can provide. And one of the ways that my mom did that for me when I was growing up was simple stuff, right? When I was, 8, 9, 10 years old, it was helping her carry heavy things. It was, get a little bit older, it's opening up the jar. It's, when you and mom are walking down the street, and he's 13, 14 years old, he should walk on the street side. He should be opening the door for mom. He should be treating her. He should have start to develop an awareness of protecting and providing. And again, the father can teach them how to do that, but the mother's the first person they actually get to, for lack of a better term, practice with. And it's very important for their development. So calling out that protector and provider in your son when they get into those 12, 13, 14 years old, 15 years old, where you expect it of them and you reward them when they do it, whether it be with simple praise or with just saying, hey, thank you for doing that. Or, I appreciate you, protecting mommy or taking care of mommy or whatnot. What that's doing is it's reinforcing in his mind that there's an expectation that he does this and that when he does it, it's appreciated. And that when he does it with respect and nobility, it's appreciated. And that all prepares him to be able to perform with courage in the moments when that's necessary. And again, it's difficult. I'm not pretending it's easy. But I can remember the first time that my son found himself in a situation where it wasn't dangerous to his well-being, but it was difficult and it was potentially physical. And me telling Tina is like, he's got to figure this out. She said, well, but I can call up and I just want to talk to the other mom about like, nope, he gets to figure it out.
How old was he?
He was probably, I think he was 12 at that point. He's got to figure it out. And it doesn't mean they're always going to win the fight. That's important. But it's one of those things where I'm proud of you for standing up for yourself. I'm proud of you for standing up for that other child. I'm proud of you, for doing that. Now, again, that doesn't mean if it's a dangerous situation, you can't still call the principal and say, I just want you to be aware of this. But don't create a false sense of security in your son's mind that when something goes bad, mommy takes care of it for him. Because one of two things is going to happen. He's either going to have this expectation where he never develops the necessary skill sets, both verbal and physical, or he's going to grow a sense of entitlement to where whenever there's a challenge, well, that's mommy's job to take care of. And you don't want to raise a little narcissist and you don't want to raise a coward. And you certainly don't want to raise a cowardly narcissist. Oh my gosh. but those are just some of the things that you can do to, again, what I call calling out the protector and provider in your son. And those are just a couple, obviously this is not comprehensive, but those are a couple things that I think can help, help a mom or a single mom kind of work those issues and also help maintain that positive relationship with her son as he gets older, because the way, all right, I'm gonna have to say this without choking up. The way I ended that video is I explained that when my wife was having our first child, it was a very difficult delivery. And when Lily was born, she had the umbilical cord wrapped around her neck twice. When they finally got her out, she wasn't breathing, she wasn't moving, and Tina was bleeding, and they couldn't stop it. And my mom was an OB nurse and she was there with us. And I remember feeling about as helpless as I possibly could. And to give you some background, at this point, feeling helpless was not a sensation I was familiar with. At this point, I was an infantryman. I was Ranger school, sniper school, airborne school. I had just passed special forces selection. I was about to go become a Green Beret. I was an infantry squad leader. Like I was pretty confident in my ability to handle myself and take care of situations. And now I found myself in a situation where I could do nothing. My little girl is not breathing. My wife is potentially bleeding out on the table and I'm sitting there helpless. Dang. And there was my mom. Right. There's my mom being there, being strong, like, honey, it's going to be okay. They know what they're doing. Don't worry. I'm watching over here, sweetheart. Hold Tina's hand. So even at that point, through all of that, through all of the work that she had done to develop me into the sort of man that she wanted me to be, and I appreciated that, at that moment, I was still just a big guy that wanted assurance from his mother. And there she was to provide it. So, yeah.
Oh, man, that almost got me.
Gets me every time.
Oh, wow. How much of that information that you just gave out regarding specifically raising boys can be converted over if you have a daughter? Like, I've always wondered, so I have a 6-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And I know how I was raised. And I think, you know, I'm alive. Things are pretty good. So I think that worked out well. But I was definitely left to my own devices to figure out tougher situations than I think I would be comfortable leaving to my daughter.
Yeah.
But I'm also not to like pat myself on the back, but I don't get stressed out very easily. And stressful situations have to be pretty life and death before I get stressed out, which I think is because I was left to solve situations that I was extremely uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
So at one point, do you just follow the same steps raising a boy and a girl and letting her figure out these tough situations? Do you think it's similar or should they be more protected?
I think there's very similar principles. There's very different applications. So here's what I mean by that. My oldest daughter, when she was in fifth grade, she had a little girl that kept threatening her at school. And this is we had put our kids back in public school for a year and then immediately took them back out again. We're like, now we're done.
Yeah.
But she had this little girl that, and I remember talking to Lily about it. I said, sweetheart, here's the first thing I want you to understand. I said, the way this little girl is behaving and the way she's talking to you and the things she's saying probably suggests that things are pretty bad at home. So I want you to have a certain element of grace for that. But if she lays a hand on you, that's a different story. And she said, well, you know, Daddy, our school doesn't let us fight. Now, we called and said, hey, look, this is a problem. But we also knew that just because we told the school it was a problem doesn't mean this girl wasn't going to hit my daughter at lunch. And I remember taking Lily and I said, well, sweetheart, you got to learn how to fight. You got to learn how to defend yourself. So let's walk through that. And we spent the rest of the night just kind of going through like, okay, how do you get your hands up? How do you throw hands? How do you block? How do you defend yourself? And I remember the first thing she said was, well, Daddy, the school doesn't let us fight. I said, you don't worry about that. I'll deal with the school, but nobody has a right to lay hands on you and you don't have the right to defend yourself. That's not a thing. So I'll deal with administrators. You just worry about defending yourself. And so we went through that whole process and it was funny because toward the end of it, she felt very confident that she knew what to do. She was going to show up to school the next day and she knew what she was going to do. She was going to start a fight. She wasn't going to try to be mean. She was going to have, you know, grace and mercy toward this girl. But the moment she got hit, she was taking her out and that was it. And she knew Daddy had her back and Mommy had her back and nobody, she was not going to get in trouble for doing that. Now, if a boy had been doing that to her, that would have been a different story. I would have been down there at the school. And if I would have needed to, I would have called up that boy's parents. And like, I'm letting you know that if your son lays a hand on my daughter, I'm coming for you. We're not going to let a school handle it. You and I'll handle it. So the thing I always reinforced to my girls is that I wanted them to be strong and I wanted them to be able to stick up for themselves. I taught my kids how to shoot at a very young age. And one of the reasons why I taught my daughters how to shoot at a very young age is because firearms are an equalizer for women. The most women are not going to be able to effectively physically defend themselves against a determined man that is bigger than them. That's just not a thing. But if they can shoot, well, then it doesn't matter how big he is. And I always wanted my girls to understand that you have a right to be able to live in this world, and you have a right to be able to pursue your dreams and do the things that you want to do without having to live in fear of the fact that you can't physically overpower a man. Now let's give you some of the tools that you'll need to be confident in being able to provide for your own security. Not because I think they should go through life having to do that. Not because I want them to live in a world where it may be necessary, but because I'm not naive to the world we actually occupy. And I want my girls to be able to defend themselves. And so from a very young age, they become very comfortable with it. But the other thing that I would say with raising my daughters is I always thought that one of the most important roles I played on that was making sure that I did spend quality time with them. And by quality, I mean paying attention, listening when they were really little, you know, having the little tea parties and stuff like that, even though I still had to be gone a lot. I also thought it was really important that they knew that daddy was there to protect them, both physically and emotionally. And one of the ways I did that was by spending the time with them. But another way that I did that, and this is also relevant for sons, is, with the way I treat their mother. Now I treat my wife with love, dignity, and respect because she is owed that from me, but I'm also very cognizant of the fact that what I'm also demonstrating is I'm showing my son how he should behave and treat his wife one day. And I'm showing my daughters, I'm demonstrating for them how they deserve to be treated by a man that they will potentially let into their lives. And I think that's very important. Not that it's not also important for sons, but I do think it's very important for fathers to be able to play that role for their daughters. The other thing I always encourage dads to do is I said, look, as much as your little girl might be embarrassed or your daughter might be embarrassed by the idea of you threatening to beat up the boyfriend or whatnot, she wants to know that you would do it. By the same token, she doesn't want you to flip out when a boy likes her. And one of the things that I used to tell my girls when they were getting a little bit older and boys were taking an interest was I would always tell them, I said, look, we got some strict rules with respect to dating and you know that, but I want you to understand that the reason why we have these rules is not because we're trying to deprive you of something. It's because we want you to have the sort of relationship that your mother and I have. We want you to be in a relationship that is safe and that is secure, but that is also exciting and passionate. And there's certain things that facilitate that. And then there's certain things that hamper or harm that. And if a boy likes you, then for me, what that says is that at the very least, he's got reasonably good judgment because he likes mm-hmm. you and you are beautiful and you're intelligent and you're wonderful. And what boy wouldn't like you? But the reason why we tell you that it's appropriate to wait, and we had the same rules for my son, was because we want someone worthy of you. And when you meet the person worthy of you, you want to be worthy of them. And so that means thinking about this and not looking so much at what you can't have right now, but looking forward to what you will have one day if you do this right. And so I think all of those things packaged together from a father's perspective helped, you know, again, and I still have to give my wife the majority of the credit for everything, but I think it did help create an atmosphere with my daughters where they knew that I loved them. They knew I would tell them the truth even when it was difficult. They knew that I also expected them to be able to think through things and figure out their own problems, but that I would still always be there for them, even if they had to tell me something that I didn't want to hear, because ultimately I'm on their side no matter what. And so that's you know some of the things that I've learned and I hope I faithfully executed with my own daughters.
That was beautiful. I think these pregnancy hormones are giving me more emotion than I usually have. That was really nice. Hey guys, if you're still in need of a last minute Christmas gift or you want to positively impact your health without really any effort, you should get an air purifier if you haven't already. I use Air Oasis. They're super quiet. They filter down to 0.003 microns, which matters. It means they actually trap fractions of mold, spores, bacteria, and viruses, up to 99% of them. This is partly thanks to their overlapping 5 professional grade technologies of HEPA filtration, carbon filtration, germicidal UV light, ionization, and silver ion screen. I believe they're the best quality air filters out there. They're the best quality air filters I've found, and that matters. You don't want to buy one that doesn't filter the proper size. It just won't work as well. Air filters won't be all you need to be healthy, obviously, but they will help limit your exposure to air pollutants. And wow, does that make a difference? It's very noticeable. Go to airoasis.com/pages/MP or press the link in the comments and use code MP at checkout. It'll give you an extra 10% off your purchase. These are really worth investing in. I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. My dad told me when I was little, this was a joke actually, but I was in kindergarten and he goes, okay, first day of kindergarten class, find the biggest kid in your class and sock him. Then you'll be on top. And prison get the rules. Friends over. Yeah, that was, anyway, that was a joke, obviously. But in grade two, I did get like people, public school is crazy. Yeah. Public school is a crazy place. My daughter's not in a public school because it wasn't great. You really get thrown in with everybody. And yeah. It wasn't a good experience for me. But I had somebody, some girl in grade two, I was in grade two or three, that came over and gave me like a good kick just out of the blue. She was just the mean girl in class. She just walloped me. And I like turned around and I kicked her as hard as I could, like directly right back. And then we were on, that was it. That was the bullying. She was like, okay. And then she was kind of friendly to me after that. It was just this, and I've got quite a few liberal friends who are now having kids whose kids are getting like bullied in daycare a little bit, being pushed around.
Yeah.
And they're being taught, go get a teacher. I was like, I don't know. I don't think the go get a teacher, especially if you're a little boy, like you were saying, it's like, no, you've got to fix these problems right away. Kids don't care what the teacher's going to say if they're already being bad. They're already in the bad zone.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny whenever somebody asks a homeschooler about, what about socialization? I'm like, have you looked at public schools lately? Are you comfortable with that socialization?
That's very true. Okay, that's very true. I know. I didn't understand when I was in it, but looking back on it, I went to like an art school and I was exposed to so many things that I wouldn't be comfortable with exposing my kids to. It was just like a downtown public school, but it was like, whoa, people were doing drugs and like when they were 13. That actually doesn't happen at every school, or you're like, you can actually have that not happen to a kid. It doesn't have to happen to a kid.
Yeah.
Anyway, I turned out just fine, but it was a wild ride, that's for sure. Okay, taking a bit of a different direction, and this is something I've struggled with, I think, as a woman, because I was raised by a stay-at-home mom. And so I always grew up thinking if I was going to be a good mom, I had to be a stay-at-home mom. And then when I felt like I was missing doing other things, I had this horrible guilt complex of, well, I'm supposed to be completely fulfilled being a stay-at-home mom, and I'm not, and I'm getting resentful, and I can feel that. And I'm very aware of that emotion because it just destroys your life. You can't, especially as a more agreeable person, you don't want resentment to take over your life. And so I've managed to like make it where I have a 6-year-old. We have a great relationship. Everything's fine now. But how, as a parent, do you balance ambition and doing things for yourself to fulfill yourself as well as being the parent at home that your children need?
Sure. Well, and look, at this point, my wife has managed the home pretty much since we've had kids. So she worked before we had kids. And we had talked about this before we got married, and I had always asked, you know, I said, I look at it as my job as being the primary breadwinner in the home. That's not to say that my wife can't work or have an income or anything like that, but I still look at it as my primary responsibility. And she said, well, that's great. I agree. And when we have kids, I don't want to have to work. Like if I might still, but I don't want to have to. I said, okay, so my job is to make enough money to where you don't have to do that. And we didn't count on homeschooling originally when we had talked about this. This is something that just kind of happened initially when I got out of the military as a practical matter. And then it became something of a moral matter as we looked at what was going on within the school system. Now, I will say that I think most women as something of a, maybe a stereotype, but one that plays out, generally have a significant nurturing capability. And they want to be able to exercise that. Now, some people are entirely content with managing a home. And I like to refer to it that way because some people, you know, I've never really been comfortable with a stay-at-home mom. And I realize it's the common vernacular, but I always say that Tina manages the home because when it comes to our home and the fact that we kind of, you know, we have animals and we have a pretty extensive garden and we kind of end with the homestead culture and whatnot, there's a lot that goes with that. The other funny thing is that my wife is the, I'm going to totally lose points for this. My wife's the handyman in the house. Like I, she's the one that where I remember when we moved in, to the last house we had, there was a water issue and she's like, I'm not paying $6,000 for someone to come in and put this filter. I can figure it out on YouTube. And she did. Like she's just incredibly, handy when it comes to that. Like the table that I'm sitting at right now, she built because we couldn't find one that's that we wanted. And she's like, I'll build it. And so she never built one before. She's like, I can figure it out. I like doing this. So she has found things that, that allow her to continue to develop the sort of skills for which she has an interest that are also either marketable or just incredibly valuable to the house, to the business, to everything that we do, at the same time that it allows her to be able to assist with our kids on the homeschooling and maintaining the house and everything else. So I think what's important is that as you look at your kids, and again, I was raised by a single mom who was a nurse. She was working quite a bit. I have a great relationship with my mom. It's not like I felt like I missed out on everything because my mom wasn't there when I got home from school every day. But I do think you have to look at the personality of your kids, and part of getting married and part of having children is they become part of your ambition. They become part of your life's mission and your journey. People ask me sometimes, why'd you get married so young? I was like, because I wanted to build a life with her, right? I didn't want to go out and do a bunch of stuff and then get married. I wanted to do these things with her. Like my life is so much more enriched with her being a part of all of it. And then when you have kids, it's the same thing, but once again, aspects of your life's ambition change. And there are sacrifices that have to be made. There's no question about that. The thing that I have found is that the sacrifices or maybe the things that you give up or aspects, maybe you don't give up the whole thing, but aspects you give up because now you got to make time for another human being. I can't think of anything that I've had to give up on that I would go back and trade the relationship I have with my kids for. It's not even close. And so I think part of it is understanding that when I got married, my wife's well-being became paramount to my whatever ambitions I had apart from being her husband. And it's not like we slowed down, right? I went off to Army Special Operations. You know, we've done all this other stuff. We're building and expanding a business right now. We can do all those things. But it was, okay, how do we do this together? And then when you have kids, it's like, okay, how do we make them a part of what we're doing? And homeschooling allows you to do that as well. Like I love it when we went to a conference the while back and, it was a homesteaders conference and Tina had made her habanero jelly. And my youngest daughter is my total entrepreneur. And wherever she works, she'll find another way to do kind of a side hustle and like, you know, make earrings or whatever it is. And she did that. And so, you know, with each one of these things, it's not that your ambition goes away. It expands to include people that you love and care about. And the space that you make to make that all work is worth it. And so that's what I would say is find ways to be able to deliver on the passions or the God-given talents and ambitions that you have. And then find ways that you're going to make room to make sure that the people that you love can actually be a part of that and maybe included in it and benefit from it as well. Because if you don't do that, what you're going to find is that you're not going to get everything out of, maybe your professional ambitions that you wish you could because you're going to feel guilty. And then, as you said, guilt easily turns into resentment and treating as if the people that you love the most in this world are somehow holding you back when in reality, there's probably a different version of that dream or ambition, which is every bit as fulfilling and even more so because now they get to be a part of it. instead of isolated from it.
Yeah, that was great. I think what's, I think this is probably on the forefront of my mind because I'm about to have another baby and I'm entrepreneurial too. I'm extremely entrepreneurial. So if I don't pursue something, it really eats at me. But I'm also at home all the time. So I'm with my daughter. And so it's just, I guess, not a way that I thought life was going to turn out. I had this preconceived notion about what being a parent was like. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anyone's preconceived notion of what being a parent is like is right, but mine certainly wasn't. So being flexible with homeschooling too is very cool. We could delve into that a little bit.
Oh, one of the biggest misconceptions about homeschool is people think that you're replicating public school at home.
Yeah.
No, you're not. In fact, I mean, look, I would have left public school just for the socialization aspects and the things that were going into the curriculum and the teaching methods. But now I look at it, it's like, well, no, it afforded me all these opportunities to be able to adapt an educational model to actually meet the needs of my child, not perform some sort of, you know, dance for the mass production of education. And so I would just say that it's funny. My wife and I talk and our faith is very important to us. And they always talk about the Proverbs 31 woman in there. And my wife was always like, man, it's intimidating. I'm like, baby, you are that woman. What are you talking about? Like you do all this stuff and you're creative and you're productive and you're caring and you're nurturing and you're loving and you're doing all of it. And so I do think some of the preconceived stereotypes that we have about what does it look like, I think it looks like spending time and investing in your children and loving them and knowing that and protecting their innocence and but also allowing them to be a part of your endeavors.
So you said one of your kids in particular is entrepreneurial. When did she start? That's a little girl, right?
Yeah.
When did she start making things and selling them?
So, oh gosh, probably when she was 10 or 11. When she was 10 or 11, she would, you know, and all of my kids have something of an entrepreneurial streak and can be very, very driven in professional stuff. We used to tell my oldest daughter, we told all of our kids when they were young, we're like, we don't owe you a college education. That doesn't mean we won't help you, but one, we don't owe it to you. And two, you should probably think about whether or not it actually makes sense for what you want to do with your life. Mm-hmm. What you need is marketable skills. You need marketable skills. So get the marketable skills that are as close to the dreams and passions and ambitions that you have that will put you in that realm to be able to do what you would really like to do. But as a responsible adult, you need to feed yourself. And I remember my oldest daughter, she loves theater. And she knows that theater is a very, very difficult thing to make a living on. So she was looking at, well, I don't want to go to college for a theater degree. I want to get a cosmetology license because that puts me in a realm of being able to do hair and makeup and everything else. And we said, okay, that's a great idea. She worked a night shift at McDonald's and then would come home, sleep, get up and work another job. She paid her entire way through it. And she did excellent. She took all of the additional courses. She got all the additional certifications. She paid it off the day she graduated. And that was hers, right? That wasn't something she was. Now, my youngest daughter, very early on, she just had this interest for the entrepreneurial. She liked the idea of making things and selling things and it didn't, which is crazy because for me, I wish I was more entrepreneurial like that. I have such a hard time selling, you know, products and stuff, right? I have a hard time with it. But her whole thing was like, no, I've made something of quality that people want, and I'm gonna put it out there and see what happens. And then I'm gonna learn from what they do. So at 12, 13 years old, she was working at, or I think it was 13, 14. She was working at a coffee shop. And you know, the owner of the coffee shop, wonderful young woman, another young entrepreneur. And she was saying, well, I noticed you sell some other things. Can I bring my earrings in? And she goes, yeah, you can bring your earrings in. She goes, and I will get a cut as the store owner and I'll take care of the tax and all, and you can do that. And Ali was like, great. So she did that. And then she moved over to a different job, but it was kind of a similar situation. And the lady said, oh, do you want to sell your earrings over here? And Ali said, yeah, that'd be wonderful. She goes, okay. Ali goes, well, what do you want as your percentage? And she goes, oh, you don't have to pay me anything. And Ali's like, no, you need to get paid. It's your storefront. It's your clientele. It's your customer base. I'm providing an additional service, but you're providing the storefront. So no, you have to get paid something. So I was just very proud that, you know, she took that attitude of not just being entrepreneurial, but understanding that this is about mutual benefit.
Do you think she learned all that from being homeschooled? Just like learning from you guys? Or does that naturally happen? It might naturally happen as well.
I think she had a natural inclination. The difference was, is that in a homeschooling environment, when you see your kids pick up on something, you don't have to say, oh, that's nice, but we've got to go through 6 hours of, you know, books so you can take a standardized test. We say, oh, that's great. You know what you should do? You should let's bring up YouTube and let's watch some stuff on how to do that. And let's talk about how you would do a storefront and whether or not you can get an Etsy account. And so when you're homeschooling, like if I would have told my son, sit at this table and study for 7 hours a day, he would have lost his mind. And now every once in a while, you have to do that. Sometimes you just got to read the book and you got to take the test. But, you know, we went to a homeschool conference once and he said, Dad, can I take the blacksmithing class? Like, yeah, sure, why not? Let's take one together. And he really liked it. We've now got an anvil and a small forge at home. And anytime like he's bouncing off the walls, it's like, dude, you're gonna go make me a knife, or you're gonna go make me this, you're gonna go make me that. And I remember my wife calling me up at one point because I was down in Richmond for the legislature, and she goes, hey, babe, I'm really happy that Luke loves, you know, out there blacksmithing, but I'm not thrilled when he's pounding on steel at midnight because you gave him a deadline.
So. Oh, that's funny. Oh, I like the idea though of introducing, you know, tools, say blacksmithing, for instance, as a way to, well, to give him something to do to like release tension. Yeah. That's cool. I like that.
And we wanted to give him something productive to do while releasing tension.
Yeah. Make some knives. That's awesome. How did you manage social media in your household? Did you just ban it? Did you allow some of it?
We allowed some of it. And that's one thing too that I look back sometimes and I'm wondering, okay, how would I have done this differently? We never had cable really with the kids past the age of like 5 or something like that. So we did a lot more on managing what they watched. And it was interesting because we were homeschooling. And again, they still had a lot of interaction with other kids and everything. But they never got into like pop culture trends. So like our kids were watching I Love Lucy and Little House on the Prairie, and they thought it was awesome because it's just what they watched with each other and with mom and dad, and they got invested in the characters. And one of the biggest, here's a cheat code for dads. I had my daughters watching Jane Austen adaptations. So BBC has a bunch of really, really good Jane Austen adaptations. My two favorite are Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice. Now, I know this sound like, quick story. I was at a pub with a bunch of my military buddies and they were having trivia night. And one of the questions was, name all the Jane Austen novels that don't have "and" in the title. And I walk over to a table full of women. I'm like, yeah, it's Emma and Northanger Abbey and Mansfield Park. And I was never here because I'm not supposed to know that, right? I'm a dude, but Jane Austen's brilliant. The reason why I tell dads this is because one, the dialogue is incredible. So much dialogue in modern movies suck. Jane Austen was brilliant with dialogue, and her insults were just top tier stuff, right? Top notch.
Yeah.
But I remember my oldest daughter, she was about 12 at the time, watching a movie. We'd been watching a lot of Pride and Prejudice and Northanger Abbey and Mansfield Park and all this stuff. And she's watching a different movie and she goes, oh my gosh, Daddy, what? He goes, that girl just kissed that boy. I said, what happened? She goes, Daddy, they're not engaged. She's going to lose her character. And I'm like, yes, you're right. She goes, Daddy, did you kiss mommy before you were engaged? Let's get some ice cream. And I forgot where I was going with all this. I'm trying to remember the original question. So we got to control a lot of what their media intake was when they were at their most formative years.
Yeah.
And then when they got a little bit older and it came time to where, they could actually go places, either they could drive or they were going places with their friends or whatnot. That's when we gave them a phone. And the moment you give your kids a smartphone, right? There's a certain degree of access that they're going to have to that. And so the way that we managed it was very simple. When we gave our kids a phone, we told them, like, this is not your phone. This is my phone. I'm letting you use this phone. And I'm letting you use this phone because you're going places. I want you to be able to call me if you ever get yourself in a bed. And it's not like they were going out partying with friends till, you know, midnight. This is like going for, you know, whatever. They were all going out to the movies, right? And they were going to be home by 9 or something. But I still want them to have a phone when they're away from me so that they can call me if they need me. But what that did was it created a whole different set of expectations. And we did this with the rooms as well. Like, you don't have a room. I have a room. I let you use the room.
Oh, wow.
And I don't do that because I'm being draconian or I'm being mean, because I afforded them their privacy. But what they needed to know was they were not allowed to do things in my house or on my phone or anywhere else, to where if I said, I want to see your phone, or I want to see your room, it wasn't, Dad, how dare you invade my privacy? Because the expectation was, is they knew it was the room I let them use. It was the phone I let them use. And so the expectation of ownership was very different. And so when I said, so now if you're using that phone and you're doing something inappropriate on social media, or you're looking at something inappropriate, I get to check your phone. And oh, by the way, I've got a degree in intelligence management and cybersecurity. You ain't hiding anything on your phone that I can't find. but I never really had to. It's not like we did a bunch of like spot inspections and came into the room once a week and checked everything, or lined them up and hand over their phones. We had a close enough relationship with our kids where we can tell when something was off. And every once in a while, I'd be like, hey, I need to see your phone. And it was, here you go. It wasn't, I'm angry. It wasn't, I'm mad. It wasn't, you're spying on me. It wasn't any of that. It was, this is Dad's property, Dad and Mom's property, and they're asking for it back, and they have every right to do that. And as a result, we did let them have limited social media. But once again, we always had the right to check whatever they were due. They would friend us immediately on their accounts. And the funny part was that initially, they love to do like little funny videos and stuff like that. And again, both of my daughters were very into theater. And so it provided another outlet for them to do kind of funny videos. And they weren't doing things inappropriate. Now, there's going to be some people that watch this and be like, oh, that guy's just naive. Okay, you can think that if you want. There's no way for me to prove to you that's not the case. All I can tell you is that if my daughters have been on my oldest daughter has been on my podcast before, you're welcome to sit down and you know, watch that and tell me whether or not you think that she doesn't possess the emotional maturity to be able to deal with that, and understand that it can be both an advantage and it can also be a horrible disadvantage if it's used inappropriately or wrong. And so I do think that we certainly tried, and I think we achieved it for the most part, of establishing a healthy enough relationship with all of our kids that when we told them to stay away from something or they weren't allowed to have something, there wasn't a great deal of questioning on whether or not we were doing it because we loved them. We were never doing it to be tyrannical. One of the biggest problems I think a lot of parents face right now is they will say things like, well, we didn't raise you that way. Whenever their kids rebel, especially if they go off to college. And I usually have to look at them and be like, well, what did you do when they asked you questions, or they asked you why, or they questioned you on something? And the parents that say things like, well, because I say so, or because you live under my roof, or because I take care of you. I said, well, no, then your kids are doing exactly what you taught them to do, which is to obey authority. It's just, you're not the authority anymore.
Yes.
So.
Interesting. Okay. So like, I had a couple of thoughts come up during that. So I know I was quite sick as a teenager. Like, I was on medication and I had an autoimmune disorder and I was a mess. So I'm sure that played into a role with instability in my life. But I remember getting a phone, and I mean, nobody had, like, people didn't really have phones, and I had a phone late, but I got my own phone. And I feel like if my parents had said something like, this is my phone, you can't have one, I would have just, because I had a bunch of jobs, I would have just figured out how to lie and scheme and get one, and then I would have hidden it. So it was like, how did you avoid having the kind of kids that would just be like, you know, that would do it anyway? But maybe just from, I mean, I suppose having kids at home and teaching them from home helped.
Oh, it helped
tremendously. Or do you think that was just That was just communication between you guys. And like, knew that it was in their best interest. What you were telling them was in their best interest.
It's a combination of factors. I will chalk a lot of it up to homeschooling. And again, what a lot of people hear when they hear homeschooling is isolation. We didn't isolate our kids. Our kids went all over the place. Like I had to campaign across the entire state. My kids went with me. We did stuff. It's not like they were unaware of what was going on in the world. But by the same token, I wasn't having to compete with a bunch of, you know, influences, like negative influences. Yeah. You know, like you said, when you show up to a public school classroom, you might have the greatest teacher on the planet. The teacher doesn't pick the curriculum, right? You may have parents that you really like. You don't know what's going on in the homes of all the kids that are sharing that classroom and sharing that environment with your child. And you don't know what ideas they're getting exposed to. You don't know what concepts they're getting exposed to. And then the popular culture thing and this expectation of, well, Sally's mom said that, you know, Dad, I don't care. I don't really have to deal with that. But by the same token, we didn't shelter our kids, right? They got a phone. There was just rules governing the phone. But so much of it was about managing what appropriate expectations look like. And the other thing too, that was really important, and this is something that my parents established with me very early on. If you lie to me, I guarantee you, whatever you've done is nowhere near as bad as if you've done it and lie to me about it. If you tell me the truth, we can work through that. If you lie to me, I can't trust you. And I'm not going to treat you like a responsible person. I'm certainly not going to treat you like an adult as you start to approach those years if you lie to me. And so we never really had a problem with our kids lying, in part because I'm going to chalk it up to two things. In part because we really did try to explain why we were doing what we were doing. And we'd let them ask questions. Here was the other thing that was pretty critical. If you teach your kids that there is such a thing as objective right and wrong, objective right or wrong can't be objective right or wrong because Dad says so or because Mom says so. It has to be right or wrong because it is, which means that at some point your kids are going to reach a certain level of cognition and comprehension to where they're going to find you doing the thing that you told them was wrong. So what happens when they call you on it? And the story I always tell people, because it's just burned in my memory. I came home from work one day. I was very stressed out. I come in, my two youngest kids are in the kitchen. Luke and Allie are in there and they are making a mess, right? That's all I see. They are making a mess of the kitchen and I'm angry because I'm already mad. And I didn't do a good job of leaving work on the doorstep before I came in. So I go in there. I'm like, I don't know what you guys are doing in here, but stop it right now. Clean this up. Well, Dad, I don't want to hear it. Clean it up. And then I stormed upstairs. So my oldest daughter comes up, knocks on the door. And what is it? She goes, Daddy, can I talk to you for a minute? I said, okay, what do you need? She goes, Daddy, I don't think you handled that very well. And she's about like 13, 14 years old. And I could remember for a split second that kind of pride welling up in me, like, you don't think I handled something very well. Well, pray tell. I had no idea you were such an expert on these things. And I remember stopping myself and it was almost like that moment of like quick prayer where it was like, okay, my daughter just had the courage to knock on the door, ask me if she could talk to me, and then had the courage to tell me that she thought I didn't handle something very well. And she's doing this all very respectful. She's not being snotty. She's not being arrogant. She's being very respectful. And I remember catching myself and going, okay, what is it? And she goes, Daddy, the reason why Luke and Allie were in the kitchen was because they got permission from Mommy to make something for you. And that's what they were trying to do. And now they're too scared because you're angry to tell you that's what they were doing. And I remember just thinking, oh my gosh. I mean, not only have I just, you know, lost all my father of the year points with my two youngest children, but now my 13-year-old daughter has just confronted me with something when I'm already in a bad mood, and she is 100% correct. And I looked at her at that moment, and there by the grace of God go I. I said, sweetheart, you're right, and I'm wrong. And I'm going to go down and I'm going to apologize to them. I said, but I want to thank you. I want to thank you for having the courage and to do it respectfully. So you did the right thing. I appreciate it. I'll go apologize to Luke and Allie. And I think what that did, and Lily and I have talked about this since, I think what that did was it helped reinforce the idea that the rules that Tina and I were setting out for our kids were not rules because we said so.
Mm-hmm.
They were rules because they were tired. They were tied to an objective morality. And like I said, our faith is really important to us. And this is always the part where people get upset with me, where I say, look, I don't know how to give you the worldview without telling you about the author of it. So if the rules came from God, right, then my job is to faithfully execute them and to faithfully raise my children to understand right and wrong and to behave in a trustworthy, honest, noble, loving, and merciful way. And when I violate that, if my response to my child is, how dare you say this to me? This is my house. I put food in your belly, clothes on your back, and a roof over your head. You don't question me. You don't challenge me. You haven't taught them right or wrong. You've taught them an unbridled, almost slavish obedience to authority. And you may think while they're under your authority that that works out just fine, but what you've actually taught them is that. And then all of a sudden, one day you wake up and you find you're not the authority anymore. And it may be a teacher, it may be a professor, it may be a friend group, it may be a boss, it may be a boyfriend or a girlfriend or whatever it is. But then all of a sudden, when they don't know how to handle themselves in a difficult situation, when they don't have the courage, the capability, or the capacity to stand up and tell authority, no, you're wrong. And to do so respectfully, but to do it nonetheless, then you've set your child up for failure. And I'm very grateful for the fact that I've now had an opportunity to witness or hear about from others times when my children have stood up in difficult situations and said, no, I don't think that's right. Whether it was to friends, whether it was to peer group, whether it was to a boss, whether it was to a teacher, whatever it was, to do so respectfully, but to do it nonetheless when it could have cost them something. And I think that's one of the most important roles that we play as parents. And I have to tell you, one of the most formative ways you will probably teach your children that, and I don't think you should set this up or intentionally do it, but one of the most formative ways you will probably teach your children that is when you fail and they respectfully call you on it and you have the presence of mind in that moment to not only admit you were wrong, but thank them for it.
Yeah. It's funny. So you're talking about faith. I wasn't brought up in an atheist household. It was more like agnostic, understanding the importance of the Bible and of Christianity, but without believing in it, if that makes sense.
Sure, cultural relevance, but you know.
Yeah, cultural relevance, but also relevance to why you should act, you should try to act like Jesus, because it makes your life like inexplicably better, but without believing in it. It's like hard to explain. So it was kind of,
noble myth.
Yes, exactly that. And so one of the main rules in my household, like the rule in my household, was do not lie. And it was hard to wrap my head around that because I didn't understand, especially from a Christian perspective, I didn't understand the difference between right and wrong, because I didn't really understand the difference between good and evil, that those were actual things in the world. I thought things were more nuanced than that. And so I didn't lie. I just got in trouble all the time for not doing what I was told to do. Yeah. But then I'd say, well, you told me not to lie. This is what I'm doing, and I'm not going to stop doing it. But I'm not going to lie about it. So that's how I was brought up. I think it would have been such a relief to be brought up knowing that there was good and evil, because it's so hard to understand the world if you don't believe that, especially with, like, in terms of other people. Because I think I only really figured this out when I was maybe 26 or 27, that regardless of what happens in somebody's past, that person can turn into a very bad person, even if what made them bad is heartbreaking and almost understandable. It doesn't really matter how you got there if what you ended up is an evil individual.
Yeah.
And I think I was completely naive to people and the evil of people until much more recently. Although, were you raised a Christian? Is this something that you grew up with?
Yeah, I was raised in what you might call kind of like a charismatic Christianity. And so I always felt that I believed in it, but I also felt like there was something missing. It seemed overly emotional to me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was in the military and there was another guy I was serving in the military with who I really respected as a man. I respected him as in SF, what we would call an operator. In vernacular terms, probably like, or in common terms would be like a warrior, right? That's, I respected this guy as a man who could handle himself and do his job and whatnot. And he was very unapologetic in his faith, but at the same time, it was very, he could debate it. He could debate it very effectively on a philosophical level, on a scientific level, on a mathematical level. And we would find ourselves in situations as we were going through this course where, you know, him and I would be debating other people. And he looked at me once, he goes, have you ever looked into Christian apologetics? I was like, what's that? And he said, I think you would be very interested. And so I went down this rabbit hole of, you know, William Lane Craig and Oz Guinness and, Frank Turek Frank Turek later on and, you know, Cornelius Van Til and Greg Bahnsen. And in addition to really pouring into the Bible and attempting to understand it, not just, you know, apply it or say, oh, this is, yes, of course this is true because this is nice and good. And this is what I've been taught, but really, really critically looking at it being like, is this true? Does this explain things well? And that's the part where in my own faith, that time of testing where it was, I want to believe what's true. I don't want to believe what just is utilitarian in nature. Oh, this works because it just does. And let's not get to the bottom of why it does. And what I discovered through a very critical analysis of my own faith was that I believed it earlier in life because it was convenient. I believed it later in life because it's true. And because I felt like it did the best job of explaining the human condition. And I found it to be incredibly logically consistent. And all of those things factored in heavily into my faith, because here's what you end up discovering. If you are believing in Christianity because it's easy, I don't know what Christianity you're subscribed to, but it isn't the one, it isn't the one I'm committed to. And I think it was G.K. Chesterton that said that it's not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting. It's that it's been found difficult and left untried. But what it does provide, and again, I don't say this from a utilitarian purpose. I think it actually explains what's going on, not just a perspective of what's going on, but what's going on, is that it does provide an explanation for meaning and purpose and identity and good and evil and what those things mean. And in a time where I feel like the entire country is going through an identity crisis, one of the things I always tell people is like, look, I've had ups and lows. I've had moments where I thought I was going to die and never see my kids again. I've had moments where marriage was difficult. I've had moments where raising kids was difficult, where I lost a job and I didn't know how I was going to provide for my family. Like I've been through some stuff. Harder than some people, nowhere near as hard as many others, but I've been through some stuff, but I've never had a question of my identity. I've never had a question of my meaning or purpose in this life. And when things go wrong, that doesn't surprise me. I expect things to be difficult. I expect there to be challenges. I expect there to be problems to overcome and deal with, because I believe we live in a fallen world, and I believe that there's injustice in the world. And I believe that one of the purposes I have in this world is to confront this and to confront that injustice in a way that actually brings glory to the person to the God that made me. And what it also does is it creates in you whether it be your marriage, whether it be your parenting, that relationship that you have with God, that relationship that you have with Christ, creates an assurance of one's identity to where it steals you. By that I mean it gives you the fortitude to be able to stand up in situations where everybody else is running. And it goes to that verse where it says, the peace which surpasses all understanding. It's not the verse that says the peace which everyone understands because everything's going smoothly. It's the peace which surpasses all understanding. It's that moment in the chaos where you can stand strong, confident in your meaning, your purpose, who you are, and what you're here to do, where everybody else just sees chaos and say, why does that person have peace in that moment? And that's why. And like I said, I will always get to this point where I'm talking, whether it's to our podcast audience or where people say, no, Nick, I like everything you had to say, but I don't see that God has anything to do with it. I said, well, then you see something I don't. Again, I can't give you the worldview without the author. And all I can say is that for what it's worth, I've come to that conclusion, not just through emotional or spiritual conviction, but what I believe to be very rigorous intellectual conviction as well. Which makes sense because scripture doesn't tell you to love God with just all your heart, just all your emotions. It tells you to love him with your strength, with your spirit, with your mind. And I think when you do that, and it's a continuous process, but when you do that, all of a sudden things make sense, even when it gets bad.
Yeah, that was very well said. I like that quote that you had about Christianity not being easy, which was my experience, because like I said, growing up, I knew the psychological significance of the biblical stories, and I knew the biblical stories pretty well, but I never understood what, I didn't have the feeling, I didn't understand it more than that. And I remember looking at people who were Christians mostly, and they seemed calmer, you know, even if things weren't going well around them, they just had a type of peace. And I started seeing that more and more. And then I saw it in my mom. And I was just like, that looks great. Whatever they have looks fantastic. Yeah. And if I could just get over this hump of understanding, I really want that. I just don't know how to get over it. So I can, and then I did, thank goodness, just a couple of years ago. But I can understand where people are coming from where they're like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
It'd be nice, yeah. But that was spot on, though. It's not easier. It wasn't easy. How do you look? That's why no one's been able to like properly explain Jesus and God to an atheist audience. There isn't an elevator. Like there are elevator pitches, but there's no way to just convey the meaning in all the meaning. Unfortunately, I don't know what has to happen to you. I feel like you have to. I had to hit rock bottom. Below what I thought rock bottom was for any change to happen to me, and then it happened.
Yeah.
So very strange. Yeah. Well, that was interesting. My husband's the one who said, hey, you should get this Nick guy on. He looks great.
Well, I appreciate it.
So yeah. So that was fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on.
No, it really is my pleasure. I have a great appreciation for what you do and for the topics that you bring up and for your willingness to be able to discuss things. I will tell you, it is as much as I believe there need to be more men out there providing kind of an alternative to some of the male backlash that's understandably happening against feminism. We need a lot more young women that are also willing to stand up and to be able to either share from experiences or, to just be able to provide a different version of what being a strong woman looks like. And so I certainly appreciate your willingness to wade into this culture, this cultural environment that we find ourselves that's oftentimes hostile to the stances that you're taking and to make them anyway. So thank you.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. It was nice meeting you.
You as well.